Good afternoon. House Judiciary Committee is in session. It's 10 minutes past 1:00. In attendance are Representative Gruenberg, Representative Lynn, Representative Ramris, Representative Dahlstrom, Representative Holmes. We're going to have before us three bills. We are delighted to have the Senator McGuire, the former Judiciary Chair, with us this afternoon. It's always a pleasure to have you in your old judiciary room, and just a pleasure. And are you going to bring this bill, Senator? Are you going to have your aides help?
Oh, and Mr. Chair, I'll have to be hearing in minutes. I'll be leaving about 1:20, 1:25. Just put that on the record.
Very good. And
I do have, Mr. Chairman, my well baby exam up in another committee in 20 minutes, so I'm going to present it and then.
Very good. And we have an extensive group of folks, primarily from the municipality of Anchorage, that wish to testify on this, although this is a bill that doesn't need a lot of love in order to make it through committee. So with those that are listening online, we will encourage you to participate, but to do so judiciously to allow us to manage the waning time of this legislative session. With that, Senator McGuire, pleasure to see you. You'd take us through 145, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the House Judiciary Committee. It's a pleasure to be back here. My first time testifying in my old digs, and frankly, I like it quite fine on this side. I have a Senate Bill number 145 before you, and if you'll notice, Mr. Chairman, we're back to the original version of the bill, which I think is a good tool. Just to be clear, what we're doing is we're amending Title 28, which is a title of Alaska state law that allows local municipalities to adopt individual ordinances that will allow for impoundment and forfeiture of vehicles. In the title, there are also watercraft and aircraft, but this particular bill only pertains to motor vehicles. And we allow for that in Title 28 for things such as drunk driving and others. And what we're doing is we're adding a new subsection 5 to allow a municipality to adopt those ordinances for impoundment for a motor vehicle that's been that is a person who has over $1,000 in delinquent traffic fines or violations committed within that municipality. And I know, Mr. Chairman, you have heard about this bill before, and certainly members of this bill have expressed, members of this committee have expressed support on the bill to me. This is just the so-called scofflaws, if you will. These are the folks in your community. There are very few of them. In Alaska, or in Anchorage, pardon me, there are only 1,017 of them. So they're not just, you know, your everyday next-door neighbor. But they amass these fines, and they simply do not pay them. And one person in our community, just using Anchorage as an example, has over 43 citations totaling $9,310. Another has 70 traffic citations totaling over $7,853 in unpaid fines. Just to give you an example of what we're talking about, the current liability in the muni is $7.5 million. So this is just a tool. Municipalities don't have to adopt those ordinances if they don't want. So it's not a forced thing from the state, but we're giving the municipalities that want to a tool.
Senator, two questions, please.
Yes.
Just for the benefit of the committee, which version, are we on the E as an Eric version?
A.
The A version.
A? Backslash A, so it's the original bill. It should just say Senate Bill number 145.
And then secondly, to your last comment, isn't it great that we have well-intentioned citizens in our large communities that wish to invest in the infrastructure of our communities? I just appreciate them so much. It's a much more direct contribution than buying a sewer and water bond. It's just great. And so we're delighted that you have devised a means to help them pay for the infrastructure that they have chosen to support with their habits. I think it's I just congratulate you on the entrepreneurial approach, and we have the A version in front of us.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Gruenberg.
Have you, on this list, have you broken it down by election district?
No. God. I wouldn't do that. They're in all of our communities, I'm sure.
Representative Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator McGuire. I think this is a wonderful bill. I'm very supportive. I have one question. I'd heard some discussion, and I know, or I've been told that you've had this discussion before and can maybe walk us through whether or not we can impound the cars without some sort of hearing, or whether we need some sort of separate charge to be brought at the time the person's pulled over. Just wanting to make sure that we can actually, the municipalities will actually be able to impound the cars under this statute. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I do, through the chair, Representative Holmes. Yeah, this is an issue, frankly, that didn't crop up right away, but by the end, when it was up on the floor, there were rumblings about an idea that comes well-placed, for sure, from the municipal attorney's office that would make the actual accumulation of over $1,000 in fines a crime. And I respectfully disagree with that position. I just think it's making a crime on top of a crime, and I have philosophical reasons for why I oppose it at this time. Now, I will submit that I would like to see this work, and if it could be proven to me in the way that the administration sets it up that it does not work, then I would be amenable to looking at it again. But with all due respect, I would like to keep the pressure the other way, is the way I've phrased it. Jerry Luckup, I've spent a lot of time talking with him about it, and certainly it would make it, you know, a more streamlined effect to have it be a crime, certainly to forfeit. But that said, you can forfeit vehicles for these kinds of things in our legal opinion, so long as you do afford notice and an opportunity for a hearing. And that's something that I feel very strongly about, to be honest with you. I think that there will be a way that the muni can do this and think about it in a streamlined fashion, but I do think that when the government thinks about seizing the property of citizens, it ought to be a very thoughtful, careful act. And there are circumstances where you could envision somebody else driving your car. You can just envision the kind of hypotheticals that would be brought up in judiciary. On the other body, it was the preacher's wife, of course, her vehicle that was being being driven. So I feel more comfortable keeping the bill the way it is and asking the muni to adopt fair articles for notification and due process. And you know, as an attorney, really when you're forfeiting, you're just simply weighing out whether there's due process and whether or not it's an extraordinary penalty for the kind of crime it is. And I think it's very justifiable. That when you have that these kind of amounts of fines and you just simply can't get the attention any other way, I think the muni has made a good case, and it has worked in other states, and I think it will work in the municipality of Anchorage. But I'd really like to keep the pressure on the municipality to adopt the right kind of processes. And so for that reason, and I just have a philosophical problem with making a crime, I can't seem to justify it. Now, if this committee, in its wisdom, can find their way through that and do it the other way, and maybe you can convince me. But at this point, I've gone through Ledge Legal, and we believe that with the right due process, that you can do the seizure without making it a crime.
Thank you. I wanted to make sure we had that conversation on the record. Thank you.
Follow up, and Representative Greenberg, you have a question?
I have here, I don't know if this has been distributed.
No.
Well, oh, it hasn't, okay. I have a couple questions. There's a House Bill 169, which I think is in this committee too, but I'm just wondering, is there any difference in effect between your bill and House Bill 169, or are they basically the same?
Representative Grimberg, I'm not familiar with House Bill 169. Is that the, can you tell us?
It's an act relating to municipal impoundment
and
forfeiture.
Did I look at it?
Yeah. It was a bill by Representative Gardner. That's the one I'm referring to. I'm just wondering if there's any difference. It doesn't look to me like there really is.
And what's your interest?
I just want to be sure. It looks to me like they basically do the same thing, and that's just what I'm asking.
All right. But we don't have that House bill in front
no,
of us.
No. It looks to me like it's basically the same, though.
Motor vehicle used by a person who's 1,000 or more delinquent traffic fine. There is one distinction, I think, and that is the motor vehicle used by a person who has 1,000 or more delinquent traffic fines for violations committed with the municipality. That's my bill.
Yep.
And the other bill says for delinquent traffic fines for moving violations committed within the municipality.
Right. That one word, moving.
Yes.
That was the only thing I saw.
Yes.
My question, if I could have that back.
Absolutely.
Is it your intent to limit this to moving violations, or could this be parking things, too?
Yeah, no, it is through the chair, Representative Gruenberg. The municipality, when they contacted me, would like it to be broader, but again, not making, they would like to, but I would not like to make it a crime. And that's because when you look through, I've got a huge list here, you can see that the vast majority do involve some moving violations as well, but some of these folks have racked up stationary fines in the thousands. And again, it's the same net effect that the chair alluded to. The rest of us choose to pay our fines. We contribute and comply, and that goes toward the overall cost sharing in our community. And the others that have approximately $7.5 million just simply say, no, we won't. And whether or not it's for a moving violation or for a stationary violation in the thousands, it's the same net effect.
I just want to get that on the record.
Yeah, yeah.
And the term, I thought that might be the difference, but I wasn't sure. Does the term traffic in there, would that necessarily include stationary and parking things? I just want to be sure if that's your intent, that we use the right term so that they don't interpret it more narrowly than your intent.
Ms. Wendy?
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to speak to it?
If we could ask.
Mr. Chairman, Wendy Chamberlain, representing the municipality of Anchorage.
Hi, Wendy.
Actually, Representative Gruenberg, we do have Dan Moore online, and he is the municipal attorney that did come forth with the legislation, and this is where all the problems seem to end up. So I'd like him to address that.
Is that okay? Could we ask him?
Yes. Dan, are you with us?
Hi, this is Dan Moore, municipality of Anchorage, treasurer.
Representative Gruenberg, would you like to state your question?
Yeah. Mr. Moore, have you been able to hear the dialogue by Senator McGuire and myself?
We've been listening, but if you could please just restate your question.
Okay, my question is, does the term traffic on page 2, line 1, clearly include both stationary and moving violations? I want to be sure that this is the right term so that they don't interpret it more narrowly than Senator McGuire intends.
Well, my understanding of the intent of the bill is that the term traffic is going to refer to moving violations. I don't believe there's any intent for it to include stationary.
Mr. Chair, given that, I would like to ask Senator McGuire again, do you want now, since the term does just include moving, do you want to leave it as it is, or do you want to do something else?
Let me ask Dan Moore, because we had gone back and forth, and my apologies, there were two different versions of the bill, and we went back to the original version. I was under the impression that the Muni had two sections of the law where they had significant unpaid fines, and some were moving and some were stationary, and that you were wanting the tool in both areas. But I want to do what the municipality wants to do. I mean, my thought is the same on both, that it's the same net effect. But if that's the way they're interpreting it now and want it to be, then that's okay with me. So can Dan Moore, can you answer that?
Sure, Senator McGuire. Our intent 10th, the two areas that we had the biggest sort of problem with that showed up in terms of unpaid fines related to traffic fines, which are truly moving violations under our traffic law that we enforce. And then the other category was criminal fines, which deal with a host of different things, but one of which that ties into moving violations would be, for instance, DUI. And so we hoped through this bill that we would be able to create an additional consequence for the most extreme cases so that they would basically literally be stopped in their tracks when pulled over on the road. And the trigger would be the amount that was owed. We don't really see this as necessarily a primary collection tool. It's much more being a public safety tool and trying to change the behavior to improve public safety going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Grunberg.
This dialogue has confused me a bit. I'm going to recommend to the sponsor and to the chair and the committee that we include, whatever it is, a definition of the term traffic fines. And I don't, that makes so much difference to me what it is, but I think it should be clear in the bill.
The other alternative, through the chair on that point, would be to say moving violations. Dan, we've gone back and forth on these. What is the rationale now for arriving at traffic fines so that we could help define that, as Representative Grunberg has stated? So it's clear.
Well, the cases that we're talking about where there's a long record of unpaid fines, they're all judgment cases that have gone through the court, and specifically through the traffic court. So they're considered minor offenses. They're moving violations. They are separate from parking violations. That's adjudicated through a whole different process. And I'm not sure. This bill has gone through various discussions and all. I just can say that we're dealing with cases that have gone through traffic court and have ended up being a judgment. And according to our law, the traffic violation is a moving violation. It's not a parking violation.
So, Dan, we're going to lose Senator McGuire shortly.
Okay.
Do you have some instructions that the municipality of Anchorage would like to share with her as to, this is a case of what's good for the goose is good for the gander, and certainly that the city of Fairbanks will benefit from enjoying the same definition. Is this a definition that should be broadened, or do you prefer the narrowness in the A version of Senate Bill 145?
Let me just ask Jim Reeves if he can just comment real fast while Senator McGuire is there.
Okay, Jim Reeves, do we have you? You're with Dan?
Yes, sir. I'm here. My name is Jim Reeves. I'm the municipal attorney in Anchorage. Thank you for this opportunity. We recognize the concern that you have about clarity on this question. My understanding is that, and I invite Mr. Moore to correct me if I'm mistaken. My understanding is that the term moving violations is a term that has a well-understood meaning, and that it would not include things like traffic tickets.
Yeah, we should do that, yeah.
We're a little bit, pardon me, it would not include things like parking tickets. Sorry, I misspoke. What we're concerned about is to make sure there isn't a misunderstanding that it does include
just as long as it's really clear
parking tickets, because that's not the purpose of this.
I just want to be sure it's clear.
Representative Grunberg would like to ask you a question.
No. I
don't know whether the words traffic violations has the same clearly understood meaning.
Mr. Chair,
the reason for the term moving violations was that we thought everyone would know from that phrase that we're not talking about parking tickets.
Representative Grunberg?
This is going to be very important.
Yeah.
And at the risk of the people getting angry at me, it might not be something you want to define on the fly, and you might want to take a little bit of...
No, actually, through the chair, Representative Grunberg, I'm quite fine defining it today. It's just a matter of one word. And I am comfortable with either keeping the language as traffic violation with the testimony our traffic fines with the testimony from the municipality that they clearly define it as those that have gone through traffic court and involve moving violations and keep it at that. My concern about saying moving violations is that we're just sitting here trying to think, but there may be things that are unanticipated that go through traffic court that wouldn't be defined that way, and I'm not sure what they'd be. I'm fine with either changing it to moving violation or keeping it what it is with traffic, knowing that it has been defined by the municipality as those violations that go through the traffic court and are moving. And just keep it at that for now. If that's where they're comfortable, I think that's better.
We've been joined by Representative Coghill. The sponsor statement speaks to $7.5 million in Anchorage alone in delinquent fines from unpaid traffic citations. So does the language as it exists in the A version, does it sweep up that $7.5 million? That's what I'm focused on, is whether the piece of legislation supports the sponsor statement, because the sponsor statement speaks to a very specific deficiency. And if we are agreed on that, then I would prefer to address this specific need. Representative Grunberg, you're shaking your head.
I'm not sure that it would cover everything. I don't know.
I believe because it has the word traffic in front of it, traffic citations, that would cover it. But I'd like to hear from the municipal attorney. But we don't really need to make too much of a big deal out of it. I want to do what they want to do.
Correct.
If they want to keep it moving violations, we could either say moving violations and just add the word moving before the word violations in the bill, and that would be on page 2, line 1, and it would be traffic fines for moving violations. You just add the word moving. We could do that. But if they could answer that question about the totals that have been given to me.
I think this question is for Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore, does you can see what the committee and the sponsor are trying to do, and as for my community, for Fairbanks, we will very politely draft in behind what is a good fit for Anchorage, because it will be a good fit, I think, for the other communities that face this problem. Can you define for us specifically what is the best language? And then at the appropriate time, I'll offer an amendment to do just that. Is the insertion of the word moving in front of the word violations satisfactory for the municipality of Anchorage?
Yes, this is Dan Moore. That would be satisfactory. It would certainly provide a little additional clarification. As Jim Reeves said, we don't want people to get confused if this somehow brings in parking violations, because there was not an intent for that. And also, just the other question about the $7.5 million, that is the grand total within Anchorage, which represents all unpaid default judgment cases that have gone through the traffic court for moving violations. So that $7.5 million is traffic fines for moving violations, and we would be supportive of that language, just to make it crystal clear.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Moore. We've been joined by Representative Samuels. Representative Lynn had to go testify on a bill. We appreciate that feedback. Are there any more questions for the prime sponsor, Representative Holmes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator McGuire, we also have the CNRA version E in front of us, which appears to add another amend a subsection R, which seems to have the department sharing information with the municipalities. I'm assuming that since that's not in the version in front of us, it was considered not to be necessary. If you could just address that briefly.
I will. Through the chair, Representative Holmes, that's a good catch there, and that's why we went back to the original version. At one point, the municipality, again, back to the idea of trying to get all the tools in their tool belt to get their arms around this debt and how to get these individuals that just are scofflaws. So one of the tools that they had thought about was asking the Department of Labor to provide information under a tight agreement where confidentiality would prevail, to share with the municipality the individual's place of work. And I actually thought it was a really good idea. We had various iterations, and I think we arrived at something that was fairly tight. The department ultimately, at one point they were supporting it, and Then they put a big fiscal note on what that would entail, which, as you know, is the kiss of death for a bill this time of year. And so we decided to go ahead and just let that idea sit out there in the interim and see what we could do to reduce that. We don't think, we respectfully disagreed with the department's fiscal note, with all due respect. We don't think it's that difficult for the department to provide this information under a confidential written agreement, and we know that this is a tremendously useful tool for a municipality, particularly when you're talking about some of these fines that are nearing 10,000 that have come through the traffic court and are clearly outstanding debts. We thought this would be a good tool, but for now we've decided to set that to the side and go with the clean version that just gives the option for the forfeiture.
Very good. Just one moment, please, Representative Kramer. The bill that passed over from the Senate, was it the E version or the
A?
It is the A version that passed over. Okay. Representative Samuels, then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and how odd to see you not in that chair. Senator McGuire, I've got three questions, and I apologize for being late, and if they have been answered already, I can get with you later. Number one, and I'll ask all three of the questions. Motor vehicle used would be if I lent you my car, not knowing that you had fines, does my car get impounded? Number two, is there a schedule somewhere in this packet, which I did not read, on $1,000 in fines? Could you get a $1,000 ticket, or is that, could it be one ticket or two tickets? Where are you? The example that I gave on the House floor when this came up was that a college kid is caught speeding on the way to the airport. Ching, ching, they're gone to school. They come back 9 months later. They are a scofflaw. They didn't ever got the ticket. They changed their address. Those types of things. $1,000 fines. How many tickets do you have to really get? And number three is within the municipality. Question within the municipality. So if I got caught speeding down here and had $10,000 of tickets,
okay,
that the troopers gave me on the drive to Fairbanks or in the city of Borough of Juneau, is there a provision where the municipality of Anchorage could then do something to me there? So it's kind of the three questions.
Okay.
Which car, how many fines does it take, and within the municipality? And my apologies if they've been answered, then I can get with Senator McGuire later.
They've not been answered. They're great questions,
yeah.
Senator McGuire.
Excellent. And what I'm going to do is respond and then allow the attorney online, Dan Moore, and Mr. Reeves to go ahead and provide more detail, because unfortunately I have another bill up at the exact same time. First of all, we went through a discussion on motor vehicle used, and before you arrived, I did talk about the fact that that's why I was so uncomfortable making it a crime to have $1,000 in fines. There was a move initially by the municipality to make it sort of a crime on top of a crime, because I do think there are going to be circumstances like that, albeit rare, that may crop up. The short answer is that we are asking the municipality to follow due process in seizing property, and that is the balance that I have chosen to strike as the bill's sponsor. If we were to make it a misdemeanor, a crime, they could simply seize the property, and that would be that. Short of that, the regular due process will be required to seize property that any government would have, and we believe that will involved, and these are my conversations with Jerry Luckup, certainly notice. Fair notice, opportunity for a hearing to explain something like that. We use the example of the preacher's wife in the other body's judiciary. She's always used, you know, the preacher's wife. And but I will say this. One goal of the bill is education and deterrence. And what we'd like people to do is think twice about who they lend their vehicles to. And we do think that that's a side note. The individuals that you're talking about in here, very few of them, and they can go through how many citations it takes to get up to 1,000, but it's certainly more than one. And if you look in your packet at the individuals that we're talking about, I mean, we're talking about folks that have 3,000, 5,000, 4,000, and multiple citations. And what studies have shown, quite frankly, Representative Samuels, is that there is a link between the propensity to commit these traffic violations, to not pay them, and so forth. The individual that hit the school bus a couple of months ago had over 25 such moving violations that were just simply unpaid. And so we do know that there is a link. That's why there is an interest in public safety from that standpoint. So it's not just about recouping the money back to the coffers of the muni, but it's that. In terms of municipality, it has the regular definition in statute that that is recognized. And then in terms of how many citations, again, I would leave it to Dan Moore and Mr. Reeves, but it's more than one. And do the members of the committee have the list of the unpaid? Okay.
See, what you're talking about is the broken window theory, that people who can demonstrate poor citizenship by not paying their fines. Good citizens pay their fines. People that are don't really feel that the laws apply to them don't act and behave as though the laws apply to them.
Yep.
And, better to flag them.
And again, the opportunity for notice, the fair, I mean, because this is the kind of a law that could be challenged if you did not have the appropriate due process measures in place. And I think the government seizing your property is a very serious matter. You guys all know that about me, so I don't take it lightly.
Senator, as I understand it from your presentation, the only amendment that I'll be offering today will be the insertion of the word moving in front of the word violation on line one, page two. Is that correct?
Yes.
All right. Very good. Representative Gruenberg?
Just a question, and this is on the the other version, the section one that's gone, because I know that the mayor had spoken to me at one time about it. And I'm trying to think if there would be a way of having our cake and eating it too. If we were, and I'd like the members to look at the old section one that's gone, and were to specify that the cost would be borne by the municipality, and secondly, a delayed effective date.
Well, and Wendy, if you want to speak to this, we actually agreed that the cost would be paid by us. And so that was, even though it may not be immediately clear to you here, that was clear to them and clear to us.
Who is us?
Clear to the folks that have been pushing this bill.
Now, who would it be paid? Who's us? Representative
Gruenberg?
The municipality, they had agreed that the fees would be borne by the municipality, and they agreed so through a series of meetings and even on the record. And then what happened was the Department of Labor came back with this, in my opinion, unfounded fiscal note based on their internal procedures and internal production that they would have to go through separate and above these fines that or fees that the municipality would absorb. Wendy can describe it to you. It's been very frustrating to me.
Senator?
I really thought we had it lined up, but.
Senator, Representative Gruenberg, we have the A version in front of us.
Yeah,
does not have
good
a
point.
Fiscal note. The E version does have a fiscal note. We have 5 days left in the session. The A version passed out of the Senate. We have three bills that we want to try and hear on a Wednesday, 7 days before the end of session. Do you have any more questions? Thank you. Senator McGuire, it's been a pleasure. Representative Samuels, you have a question for the bill sponsor?
I'm sorry, I still have one question on the motor vehicle used, and I want to push back a little bit on the be careful who you lend your car to. And I gave this example, Mr. Chairman, on an earlier bill on motor vehicles, and I said I would lend my car to everybody in the table and half the people in the room, and I'll let the people in the room decide which half I wouldn't lend my car to. But that's the reality. If you asked me to borrow my car, Senator, I would throw you the keys and say, I have no idea if you have $1,000. So I understand. After reading the statistics, I get it. I get the how many what you're after, but on the lending your car, you just that's a tough
yeah,
thing
I
to
think
say. Is to be careful who you lend your car to, when quite frankly, I would lend my car to most people in this room.
Well, and on that point, I don't just say that. I say that is one point of a law like this, is the deterring behavior that you hope you get, but I don't say it in sort of flippant way as if it's not important. I also say it connected to the other thought that I have, which is that I don't want to make it a criminal endeavor, and I do want due process to fetter out. That is important to me. And I do think that the fact that you are completely unaware of this individual's propensity for moving violations, you gave it to him in an emergency, you gave them to him in good faith, and they drove your vehicle, I do think that's a factor.
Okay. I just want to get that back.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Senator, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure
it's
to,
fun.
Pleasure to see you.
Come back.
All right, let's go to the other folks that we have before us, and we invite your full testimony, but it's 1:45, and we have two other pieces of business we want to try and get to today. Steve Smith with us with the Anchorage Police Department?
Yes, sir, I'm present.
Do you have some testimony, Mr. Smith, or you just want to answer questions?
Well, we'll keep it very brief, and I think Senator McGuire put her finger right on it when she said that this is a tool, a worthwhile tool for law enforcement to help change the behavior of those people that our current tools obviously aren't getting through to. I had some other thoughts, but they'd be redundant at this point, and I want to be respectful of the committee's time, so I'll just stand down for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Other questions for Mr. Smith? Seeing none, we appreciate you taking the time to offer your support on behalf of the Anchorage Police Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We've heard from Dan Moore and with Jim Reams, so we will come back to them if there are any specific questions. Next on our list is Josh Freeman with the Municipality of Anchorage. Josh, are you with us? Josh?
Yeah, I have no testimony. I'll be here for questions.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dan Moore. Can I just respond to Representative Samuel's question?
You certainly can. Thank you, Dan.
Okay. There was a question asked a short bit ago about how many tickets might be triggered with this law. If you just look at straight averages, the person would have to have on average about 7 outstanding delinquent traffic tickets. And so that's kind of the ballpark measurement. Also, the population that we're dealing with here, there's 23,000 individuals, unique individuals that owe delinquent traffic fines. However, we're only dealing with about 4 to 5% of that population through this bill, which are the what they call the high flyers, the people that are most at risk of committing additional traffic fines and also putting other people's safety at risk. So I just wanted to follow up on that. And the last point is, in terms of someone borrowing someone else's car, the Municipality of Anchorage does have a website that's updated daily. And so if someone were curious whether their friend or relative had a long track record of unpaid fines, they could go onto the city's website and look up the name, and it would tell you all the fines that are out there that we show are unpaid.
Dan, thank you. It's always heartening to know that Big Brother's working.
Okay, thank you.
And the question I have for you very quickly is, let's say I have a car that has a blue book value of $10,000, I have $1,000 in fines. Do I forfeit the whole value of the vehicle or only the value of the vehicle to pay off the fines? Or how the Municipality of Anchorage or the City of Fairbanks can't make a profit off of this, can they, or the way that it's presently written?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to ask the law department to respond to that, since they manage the program here for Anchorage.
All right. Do we have somebody with law there?
This is Jim Reeves. I'm the municipal attorney, but I'm going to turn that over to Joshua Freeman, who's the assistant who administers the program.
Very good. Josh?
He can explain that.
Josh, if you'll introduce yourself for the record, please.
Joshua Freeman, assistant municipal attorney. As far as forfeiture, right now we have it set up as it will be a crime at the municipal level, even though the state hasn't authorized that yet. Prospectively, it would be a crime and such that if there was two convictions, the vehicle would be forfeited completely. That's how our DUI ordinance is set up and our suspended license, so it would just follow those parameters.
And frankly, this is Reeves. Frankly, if the bill passes in its current form, we will have to revisit this with the Assembly, because the Assembly's ordinance, the Assembly's approach to this was predicated on the fact that it would be a criminal act for the individual to operate a vehicle when the individual is in the scoff law category. If it's not a criminal act, then we run into constitutional questions about forfeiture of the vehicle. Well, because it's not being used in the commission of a crime. This is simply a creditor's remedy.
Okay, very, very good. Mr. Fernelli, do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the opportunity. No, I think everything that I would add has already been addressed, and so I would stand down for questions at this time.
Thank you. And we received an email from Director Bannock saying he was online to answer questions. However, he's needing another committee at 1:30. pass on his apologies. The DMV fully supports SB 145. Are there any other, is there anybody here in the room that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 145? And are there any questions from committee members, Representative Samuels, for anybody that we've heard from this afternoon?
Thank you, and I don't care which one does it, but traffic violations, if I get a speeding ticket on the Parks Highway, let's say, out of the municipality, and I got my 20 tickets or whatever, and then I get caught in Anchorage, are those show up in a record? Can the municipality then impound, or do they have to be only the $1,000 fines that are within a municipality? And the way I read it, it's that, but is that the intent?
Gentlemen?
Mr. Chair, this is Dan Moore. Representative Samuels is correct. The intent is definitely only traffic fines that are committed within the municipality of Anchorage or any other municipality boundary. Just speaking for us, we would enforce this just based on traffic fines issued by Anchorage police officers within the bounds of the municipality of Anchorage.
Thank you. Representative Samuels has a follow-up.
Thank you. And I will not be offering an amendment or anything, but if the state wished to do the same thing, you would just have to have your own procedures set up, whether the state could then impound the vehicles also instead of the local assembly.
Dan, can you speak to that?
Maybe I'll ask Jim Reeves to respond, please.
I think the answer to that question is yes.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
We've been joined by our friend Representative Book, who's hiding in the back of the room. Representative Coghill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to get a little context, maybe the person who is supposed to administer this in the municipality, under the forfeiture laws now, we have sections 3 and 4, that say a motor vehicle used by a person. Has it arisen in the circumstance that a person who didn't own the vehicle was responsible for having a vehicle impounded, and how has the municipality handled that?
Is your question whether the person driving the vehicle was driving somebody else's vehicle?
That's the first question. Yes.
Yes, we have that happen quite often. There's procedures in the code. What they call is the innocent owner defense, and it's possible for owners of the vehicle to provide evidence to show that they didn't know or have reason to know that this person would drive the vehicle in violation of the law.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions for the folks that are online? Seeing none, public testimony is closed. Susan, I'd like to offer conceptual amendment number one. On page 2, line 1, I want to insert the word moving in between the word for and the word violations, so that the sentence would read, number 5 on page 1, motor vehicle used by a person has $1,000 or more in delinquent traffic fines for moving violations committed within the municipality. Are there any objections to amendment number 1? Seeing none, amendment number 1 passes. Are there any other amendments? The chair would entertain a motion. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move the Senate Bill number 145, version A, with conceptual amendment number 1 and individual recommendations.
Thank you. Senate Bill 145, without objection, moves from the Judiciary Committee. We'll take a brief at ease. A considerable amount of time on House Bill 250, but we wanted to get a hearing on all three pieces of legislation today. And in discussion with the sponsor, we're of the opinion that House Bill 250 will be held over so that we can address the fiscal note and some of the other outstanding issues with what we hope will be an excellent piece of legislation, and the Judiciary Committee is anxious to work with the bill sponsor on that. But for that reason, we will take up HJR 2. If the members will, we need to adopt the E version. HJR 2, Representative Samuels.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I move that we adopt the CS for HJR 225-LS0257-E lockup as a working document.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman,
I
don't believe I have that version. I don't
the E version?
Let me get you a copy of it. Yeah, I don't believe I have it.
We'll bring the E-version to you. Do any other members need the E-version?
Oh, here's an extra copy.
Here's a copy. Right, thank you very much. All right, so we have the e-version before us. Presenting today are Representative Crawford and Vice Chair Dahlstrom. And we have, wishing to speak on this, Pamela Smash, speaking on behalf of herself, Debbie Jocelyn with the Eagle Forum, Ed Moglen from the Kenai with the Alaska Nonprofit Charitable Organizations, and Leonard Wells speaking for himself from Homer. With that, Representative Dahlstrom and Representative Crawford, if you would take us through the E version of HJR 2, please.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Crawford.
Because I'm going to need to go to House Finance, we're dealing with amendments for AGEA today. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have to go fairly quickly. So if I can make some brief comments, and then I think Representative Dahlstrom is going to be left with the heavy work here.
Okay.
One of the reasons, one of the main reasons why we brought this up is because we believe that the duties of the legislature were being usurped by a citizens initiative that was brought forward over the last couple of years, that what it does is it forms a commission appointed by the governor, and the way the initiative was sold out on the street, and I know this to be true because I stood by many of them when I was gathering signatures myself, that they said this was an initiative to regulate gambling. Many times they never, ever mentioned that what they were doing was opening this up so that there could be an expansion of gambling without there ever being a vote by either house of the legislature. That's the reason why we've come forward with a constitutional amendment, because I am truly horrified at the prospect of a appointed commission having the ability to rule on this without our consent. We can talk about the ills and evils of gambling all day long because they're myriad. But more so than anything else, the reason for a constitutional amendment is so that both the houses of the legislature and the people will have a chance to weigh in before we expand gambling to for-profit gambling. We're one of the last two states in the union that have not gone to for-profit gambling. And Mr. Chairman, I just absolutely don't want to go down this road without there being a very high bar.
Thank you, Representative Crawford. Representative Dahlstrom, do you wish to add?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's a pleasure to be on this side of the table. Interesting.
It makes me nervous.
Representative Crawford and I have been working on this issue and others related to it over the last several years, and we both share a passion for this issue, and it's for many reasons. It has to do with the economics, what happens to our state or any state that gambling takes place in and becomes a readily accepted activity. It has to do with what it does to families. It has to do with the addiction problems, and it has to do with the proven statistics that crimes raise in every area that gambling has been legalized, especially the higher forms have been expanded. And these are areas that, you know, fortunately, we as a state have the distinction of being one of the most beautiful states in the country, and we are one of the most desired places to come on vacation. And yet, at the same time, we have the unfortunate distinction of being either number one or always in the top five of the highest rate of suicide, the highest rates of incest, the highest rates of alcoholism, the highest rates of child abuse. Bankruptcies are rising at a horrific number. Rape numbers were always right up there in the top. And these particular situations in every state that has been studied have always increased whenever gambling has been expanded or allowed to become legal in those states. I don't feel, and I know that Representative Crawford feels the same way, I don't feel that that's a risk we want to take for our state. There's studies that prove that for every dollar that someone benefits from gambling, that it costs society $3. And that is to pay for addiction programs, it's to pay for the additional folks that end up on welfare, the families that fall apart, the families that lose their homes, who lose their jobs. It's very, very common in areas that have large casinos that there are domestic violence shelters nearby, and often not just one, but sometimes two or three. The Office of Children's Services, or whatever the appropriate name is in each particular state, their caseload increases. The police departments and trooper responsibilities increase. The physical notes go up with that. And I don't think that's something our state wants to do. But more importantly to me, even over all the economics of the whole thing, is what it does to disrupt families. And I firmly, firmly believe that it does. I believe that the statistics are there that prove it. And I know that not everyone that gambles becomes addicted. And some people have the ability to gamble and to enjoy it and to walk away from it. But I also know that the statistics prove that there are more people who start out gambling as something fun, it becomes a habit, and then it becomes an addiction. And we all know what happens with an addiction, whether it's food, whether it's alcohol, whether it's gambling, whether it's an abusive type situation. When it's an addiction, it's out of control, and it causes problems that not only hurt that person, but the entire family, and we as a society end up paying for those. So with that, I know we have people online to testify. That kind of just gives you a little broad intro onto why we were doing this. But I'd also like to state for the record, too, this bill clearly does not affect anything that is already in law. It has to do with expanding any gambling. Things, pull tabs, bingo, things that are already in the law, that money is going to charitable events, are not affected by this at all. So I do want to clarify that, because that question did come up in the last committee. So with that, Mr. Chair, we'll stay put and answer questions or
thank you, Representative
whatever we can.
Are there any questions for Representative Crawford from members of the committee? Representative Crawford, thank you very much. I know if you've got to get up to finance, we appreciate the work that you're doing up there.
He's letting me know when I need to be there.
We'll let you know.
Okay.
Very good. Are there questions for Representative Dahlstrom on this issue? Representative Sam?
Thank you. I'll have one comment. I too was approached by the Gambling Initiative people, and I too think that the initiatives usurp the power of the legislature. I wholeheartedly agree with you, Representative Crawford, on a number of initiatives. I was told various things when I got handed a book, and I didn't sign any of them. So, just as a little side note. Secondly, the big question here is on page 1, line 13, all profits. And I know the intent, but I'm going to get on a limb because I don't understand completely how the opposite. But if I own a pull tab parlor and what you would consider profits go to charities, I also keep a profit for myself and I make a living doing that. So that's not, I mean, you got two pools. After I, expenses and a certain profit that I make, because I know somebody who owns a series of pull tab parlors and he makes a living doing it, and then he gives the rest of the money to charity. So he does make a profit. That'd be my first question.
Representative Crawford.
The reason why we put that in there was to clarify what we were talking about here, and we're not changing the regulations and statutes that already govern the charitable gaming. And we this was just to reiterate that.
And for the record also, Mr. Chair, I'd like to state that, you know, neither one of us are naive enough to not know that there are some businesses, as in any business, no matter what type it is, there are some bad apples. And in the charitable gaming industry that is already existing, there are some that are abusing it. And this bill does not address that. In the future, maybe that's something that we might choose to together work on and tighten up. But the intent that was originally set up with the charitable gaming is good, and it's done. It's in law, and our I know many of the tribal organizations, many of the very good organizations that help abuse children, abuse women, just do all kinds of things. Build parks, depend on money, and it's become a regular source and a regular stream of income for them.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I want to thank the two members for bringing this forward. I think having high bars for gaming to come into the state, especially in the big commercial way, is you're exactly on the right. But there are some things that I'm going to probably question as far as how this is drafted. I don't know, and I'm going to have to do some research, maybe you've got it, that a constitutional amendment requires that the legislature can make a law that's ratified by 60% of the people and a municipality. So that probably wanders into a whole new arena of how laws are made. I think it's foreign to our Constitution. So I'm going to look at just the structure of it, because that does ratchet the bar up, no doubt about it. But I know that in our Constitution, we have by law is generally meant either by initiative or by legislature. In this one, you're going to require two groups that have the authority to make law having to agree. And I think that's a little foreign to our Constitution. I need to do some research on it, that's all.
Representative Gruber.
I raised a number of questions in the last committee, and I have notes if you want to see them. I still have a number of questions about the bill. I want to focus a bit on the differences between this bill and the previous version, because I think there have been some improvements. But I want to point out one thing in here. Consider for a moment I'm a sharp lawyer representing the ABC Gambling Company, whatever you want to call it. I'm just going to set this out, this casino up, right outside the municipal borders.
Point made, that's where we have our fireworks stands.
Right
outside of the city of Fairbanks.
What I'm saying is that they'll be very easy to evade this.
Mm-hmm. Representative Crawford.
For any form of gambling, not for any particular location, but for any expansion for any form of gambling, there'll have to be a general election vote across the state. So that means if it's expanding to electronic gambling or expanding to casino gambling, any form will take a general election. Also, if it's located in a municipality or borough, then there will also have to be a local election. But we're not saying for each and every little location there has to be a general election, but we are saying that for if Wasilla wants to have card rooms, there'll have to be a general election and an election in the municipality. So the reason why we wanted that in there was so that Even though the state said, yes, you can have card rooms, Wasilla could still ban those card rooms.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to that.
Representative Grunberg.
I know that the Anchorage voters won't pass an ordinance. They won't. And frankly, when you say approved by the municipality, I'm not sure if that means approved by just some bureaucrat in the municipality, or does it have to be a vote of the city council, or does it have to be ratified? That's another issue. But let's say they know they're not going to want the casino outside, and there's been some kind of a general law that would allow it to be done. They'll evade the municipal check by simply doing it right outside the borders. That could be cured by requiring it to be in a municipality, so voters locally would have to approve it.
Thank you. If you can respond just briefly, Representative Dahlstrom, I'd like to get the public testimony, and then we can come back to the committee to discuss this. I don't want to just keep rehashing the same point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And on line 10 and 11 is where the issue has come up that we're addressing right now. And in my discussions with the Department of Law and others on this, the reason we chose this wording was to avoid exactly the potential problem that has risen here, so that the people in, say, Anchorage might not have the opportunity to say, well, we don't want a casino here, but we want to build one in Seward or in Kotzebue. The people in Seward or Kotzebue would have to have a vote. And my understanding is that the wording that's here, and maybe we do need to tighten it up a little bit or change it, but that this was sufficient wording to cover that there would be a vote in each of those places.
It would only be if it was in the borders. Otherwise, they'll just locate it outside the borders.
Representative Grunberg, you brought up the same point three times, and I'm happy to entertain it, but we're just going back and forth on the same point. Do you have any new questions for the bill sponsors?
No.
Representative Samuels, do you have a new question?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
And I don't need the answer this very second, but thank you, Mr. Chairman. I saw that we didn't have somebody at Department of Law online, but gaming or gambling, to me, there's a big difference between playing roulette or playing blackjack, which are complete games that you're going to lose in the long run the odds. Somebody pays for the lights in Vegas, right? As opposed to playing a game of poker where you're playing other players and it is more of a game of skill. People do this for a living, as opposed to you're going to lose if you play roulette long enough, period. Math works. So are those defined in statute? I do not need the answer at this time, but is a question sometime in the future that I'd like answered.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I just might add, the reason on page 7 of section 15 we chose the words any form of gambling is so that we purposely did not want to list, you know, 20 different types of games, because people are smart. They'll create the 21st and 22nd and 23rd type of game that won't be included in this legislation, and that defeats the intent of this.
Okay, any more questions? Rhetorical, old, new for bill sponsor? Good? All right, very good. Let's go to public testimony, please. Leonard Wells and Homer, are you with us, Mr. Wells?
Yes, I am. I just had a couple of questions or comments. On the non-state level voting, would that also have to be at a super majority passage, you know, for a municipality or a borough to allow gambling? And on a borough level, if somebody was looking to put it outside of the municipality, would the city folks have a vote in it, since they aren't included in the borough population where it's being placed? Because in my mind, since they are their own sub-entity, they, you know, they might not have it. And also wondering why one would have anything more than a simple majority as the hurdle to get over. I realize the sponsors dislike the idea and probably would make it 90% if they could. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the questions. Representative Dahlstrom?
Mr. Chair, just a very quick response. The issue of the supermajority, the 60% rather than 50 plus 1, was brought up in the previous committee, and I will tell you that the other prime sponsor and I are amenable to discussing that. And the quick answer to your second question is I agree with you that if an outside area is the area that is contemplating putting in a building or a gambling type institution, our intent is the vote is held by the people that live in that area only. Anchorage isn't going to determine what happens in the city of Wasilla. The people in Wasilla would need to vote.
Very good. Thank you. Do you have any more thoughts, Mr. Wells?
No, okay. I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your participation. I appreciate it. Next, I'd like to go to Ed Moglen in Kenai with the Alaska Nonprofit Charitable Organizations. And Mr. Moglen, your testimony should be directed toward the committee. I don't want to put you in the position of cross-examining the prime sponsor. So if you'll share with us your thoughts, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, committee members. My name is Ed Moglen. I'm with the Alaska Charitable Nonprofits Organization, representing veterans and community service organizations with affiliates across the state, serving our state, our community, and our nation's veterans. I'm speaking in favor of House Joint Resolution number 2 for the same reasons as the sponsor's statement for the potential in doing harm in our communities and state, as well as putting for-profit organizations in competition with charitable community and veteran service organizations with their gaming permits. These gaming permits are essential to these community service organizations in providing resources for charitable service to their community and to the veterans in our state and nation. Some forms of gambling could cause harm to our communities, as well as the whole state, and the responsibility and the misgivings of that said gaming or gambling brings with it. I feel it's the right of all the members of the state of Alaska to be able to vote on any particular gaming or gambling issue that could have misgivings or cause any harm to the communities, the state, or the charitable service organizations in providing an unfair competition also. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any questions from members of the committee for Mr. Moglen? Seeing none, we thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we go to our friend Debbie Jocelyn with Eagle Forum. Debbie, how are you? Debbie?
Not there.
No. Did we lose her? Okay, and then if I can direct the members to right behind the E version of the bill, you'll see testimony for HJR 2 by Pamela Samish. Pamela, you're with us. Would you make your remarks, please? Everybody has a copy of your testimony. It's very compelling. I appreciate the candor in it and the narrative that you tell, and I'd appreciate it if you would offer any testimony you have, but it won't be necessary to read us your particular your written testimony as we all have it before us. Are you with us, Pamela?
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome this afternoon, and thank you for the tremendous candor in your letter. It's a very emotional, and it is precisely why the prime sponsors have brought forward HJR2. What kind of thoughts would you like to add this afternoon?
Well, I was wondering, could I make a comment and then say my testimony? And I wasn't going to read that one because that's way too long. I know that I only have about a minute and a half.
You have all the time that it takes. I just didn't want to be redundant, but we'd be delighted anything that you can add to this. Please feel free.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. First, I'm sorry, please forgive me. I don't know who it was that made that comment about putting the casinos right outside the border, but that was a really good comment. They would so do that. So that is definitely something, if you guys could be sure to address that somehow, because that they would do that. They are just like that. So, but thank you so much. This is my testimony. Hello, everybody. Thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. My name is Pam, and I'm calling Pamela Samash. I'm calling from Nanana. This bill is something I support since gambling is a very serious issue with me. The reason for that is because of, obviously, you have my testimony, the personal experience of watching the mistakes my family has made and the research I did. You guys have my testimony, so I really don't need to say probably all of this, but please do whatever you can to keep gambling out of Alaska or to at least make it fair for the voters to decide. This activity is addicting, especially to those who have previous or ongoing addictions already or those whose families who do. My mom said it's one of those things that people think will never affect them and that they'll always be in control, but for many people that's just not true. I won't get into my mom too much because you already know, but gambling is set up in a way that people forget the cares of life. This is still from my mom. They're wrapped up in the excitement of the winnings regardless of the huge losses. And my mom lost everything due to gambling and is still rebuilding her life. Let me skip over this part. With a high rate of drug and alcohol abuse, and I do believe this is already addressed too, and the winters here and the depression issues that many people deal with, these issues leave them vulnerable to gambling addictions. Also, please keep in mind that when adults are gambling, somewhere they have children. Who's taking care of their kids? Please always remember the children. They are the first in line to pay the price of gambling. When their parents' lives fall apart, they are powerless and suffer and go down with them, but usually with a lot less emotional support. So this concludes my testimony today. I hope when you decide on this bill that you will think of our family and of the real risks that are involved. And I really appreciate you and everything you're doing, and I'm really proud of Alaska for being one of two states that still does not have casinos. I am just really proud to live here and say that. I also hope you aren't persuaded to believe that this, sometimes they'll say it's, you know, for schools or, like you were saying, for charity, and, you know, that's just enticing words. It's totally devastating to families and communities, and no amount of money can fix broken homes and broken lives. Thank you.
Very compelling, Pamela. It's brave of you to come forward with such personal testimony, and I wish you and your family Godspeed in recovering all the things that that were lost. Are there any questions for Pamela? Thank you very much for your testimony. We appreciate that. Is there anybody else in the room that wants to testify on this? Do we have anybody else online? Okay. As such, public testimony on HJR 2 is closed. Representative Dahlstrom, would you like to rejoin us at this point as we go back into committee discussion?
Yes. Can I just make one more closing statement?
Absolutely.
Mr. Chair? Okay. In our state, we have approximately 600 and some odd thousand people that live here. And I have some statistics that are rated per 100,000 adults. And if I can just read them very quickly. In a typical county of 100,000 adults, the introduction of Class 3 gambling would create additional society costs of $14.3 million annually, and a social benefit would be $4.6 million annually. In counties where they do have Class 3 gambling, approximately 10% of crime was due to gambling. And in counties of 100,000, that means 615 more larcenies, 325 more burglaries, 272 more auto thefts, 10 more rapes, 65 more robberies, and 100 more aggravated assaults. And I trust that this committee is going to ponder this bill and make any appropriate changes if necessary, because I know we all have the best interest of Alaska at heart, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there any final questions for the bill sponsor? Seeing none, we will take this back to the committee. Is there any committee discussion on HJR 2?
Mr. Chair, I'll move it when you're ready.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Coghill.
I struggle. I understand you want to go ahead and move along on this, but having a, I understand why you have the sidebars in here, that is, unless it's authorized by law, but then we have a ratification of a 60% majority of the state of Alaska. I understand the barrier we're trying to get over, but I just don't know that I want to start down having that in the Constitution. You know, first of all, most of what we've done down through the years has been by a majority vote. And I don't know that I want to start a supermajority by enshrining it in the Constitution. So I understand why we want communities to be involved in it, but maybe the sponsor could help me with that.
I will, and before we hear from the sponsor, my intention is to offer an amendment to delete the word 60% from this so that it does conform to the Constitution. That is a majority plus one is the state that we choose to live in. Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that would be a very friendly amendment.
Are there other concerns with HJR 2?
There's maybe one other, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Parker.
It might be better to say approved by any municipality where the gaming or gaming may occur. I would want to say it that way, only because I think you're going to run into, I think you could run into an issue there. But
lines 10 and 11?
This is on lines, 10, where any approved by any municipality where the gaming or gambling may occur. And I think, I just think that's, number one, more artful, but then secondly, it really highlights the municipality. We're going to have a permissive, and I wanted to make sure it was permissive in the legislature. So I haven't drafted up any I could do that in further committees if you wish. But and then one other question, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Cargill.
On page 1, line 13, at the end of the line, it says only. And putting in Constitution the word only, remember, that's exclusive to all other things. And I can see us getting into some issues where those profits are only expended for charitable purposes. That means if you're going to have any other cost involved with it, you might have a problem. So I think, I don't know how to deal with that, but that is so exclusive that I think you run afoul somewhere.
Representative Dahlstrom.
So through the chair, Rep. Coghill, if understanding the intent, if we were to just take out the word only,
I think that would be more appropriate.
Would be the best thing to do also.
Okay. Is there other committee discussion on HJR 2?
Did you make a motion to do that?
I'll follow the chairman.
All right. Susan, I'm going to make a conceptual amendment number one, which is on page 1, line 9, to delete the words 60%, so that it would read, form of gaming or gambling has been authorized by law ratified by a majority vote of the qualified voters of the state who voted on the question of the next general election. Are there any objection to amendment number one?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bloomberg.
Did we ever adopt this committee substitute?
We did. Representative Samuels adopted version E. Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number one? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number one passes. Representative Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move conceptual amendment number two on line 10, reading and approved by any municipality, deleting the word the, and deleting the word if any. So it would read and approved by any municipality where the gaming or gambling, and then delete will and insert may occur.
Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number two? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number two has passed. Representative Cocco?
Mr. Chairman, I move conceptual amendment number three, which is on page 1, line 13, at the end of the line, deleting the word only.
Is there any objection to conceptual amendment number three? Seeing none, conceptual amendment number three passes. Are there any other amendments from the committee members? Representative Grunberg?
My concern is that I know that there is so much money involved that this will be examined very, very, very carefully by them that want to do this. And I raised a number of issues in the last committee. And I am concerned, and I don't want you to think that I'm picking nits at this, mm-hmm. that it would be, I think, and I'm sort of speaking to the bill sponsor here, I don't know how she wants to handle this, to have this looked at, as my law partner used to say, three ways from Sunday, by a lawyer who really specializes in this and can show you all the loopholes that could be raised with this so that they can be closed. And whether you do it in this committee or another committee, I strongly recommend that that be done. Otherwise, people will find and exploit any possible loophole in this.
Thank you, Representative.
Because I can see a bunch of them.
Representative Dahlstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Grunberg, I would like to take you up on your offer. My
and I'll be happy to work with you, but I'm not an expert.
My preference is to move the bill from committee today and then take those specific concerns. I've had it looked at previously by folks on both sides, operators on both sides of the issue, but as many eyes as we can have on this so it's done correctly is good, and this will need to go through the other body, also judiciary there, and so we can have all those.
My suggestion is, and maybe I can even, we can find a lawyer, maybe not even Alaska, who specializes in this and can just show you so you have a list and see how this thing can be closed. And this is not a regular statute, and it's in the Constitution, but I am concerned that this will be just like Swiss cheese and they'll go right through it.
Mr. Chair, just for the record, and hopefully it'll ease Representative Grunberg's mind a little, I am working with several lawyers in-state, out-of-state, and I would be happy to get the names from you of those other folks.
I don't know anybody off here, but
okay.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Lynn?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good resolution. I would move CS for House Joint Resolution Number 2, 25-LS0257/E. With individual recommendations, and is there a fiscal note at all in this? With attached fiscal note.
I'm sure there must be for 1,500.
Yeah, I would think so.
Is there any objection? Without objection, HJR number 2, version E, passes from the House Judiciary Committee.
Three conceptual amendments. But I think you'll apply.
Okay, if we can take up House Bill 250, please. Representative Dugan, nice to have you. Let me share with the committee, it's 2:30. The chair has no trouble staying after. How are the members set for time?
We have chairman. I have a conference committee that will take Mr. Grunberg and myself.
At 3 o'clock.
Okay. And I can be here, Mr. Chair. I can be here. Important bill.
I have one thing up that's going to be up in finance, so I can run up and run back down.
Okay.
Thank you.
Very good. And we have considerable testimony on 250 from the office, from the OPA, from a task force on pre-adolescence, STAR, which was previously run by Representative Faircloth, APD. And some folks here in the room with Division of Behavioral Health, with the Department of Law and Health and Social Services. Thank you. With that, Representative Dugan, welcome to House Judiciary. Thank you for being patient with us. It sounds like we can maintain a quorum and get as far as we can get, at least to take in public testimony and address what some of the issues are that we'll want to work through on House Bill 250. We're happy to have you in committee. If you introduce yourself and your associate and introduce us to House Bill 250.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Mike Dugan. I represent House District 25. This is Ryan Jagger from my office, who has the unenviable job of working with me on this particular piece of legislation. Since this committee is well known throughout the building as being a committee not to be messed with, Mr. Chairman, I want to begin my testimony by apologizing for a couple of things. The first is that House Bill 250 is not a finished bill. This, as we'll see as we get into the testimony, is a difficult and troubling subject with a lot of problems in terms of how the state can help to deal with it. The second is that the subject matter is both startling and dispiriting. Before I got this job, I was a journalist in Alaska for more than 30 years, and I thought I'd seen it all until I came to find out that I hadn't. Before I go any farther along this line, I want to say that this is not really just me at work here, in addition to Representative Dahlstrom, who's a co-sponsor of this, and Senator French, who's the sponsor of the bill on the Senate side. This comes out of the work of the a task force on pre-adolescent children with sexual behavior problems that was meeting for a considerable period of time.
If I may, Madam Chair, I just co-sponsored this bill today.
Thank you, Mr. Lynn.
Thank you, Representative Lynn. But these folks worked on this for a good bit of time and produced a report, which I can provide to the committee members if they'd like. I don't know how it is in your office. In mine, I get a lot of paper that I don't necessarily want. So what was provided in your packets was a sort of a summary of sort of their conclusions. What they came up with was pretty comprehensive and very expensive. It had about a $10 million fiscal note. I may be a freshman, but I'm not naive enough to think that I was going to be able to get an entirely new department and $10 million worth of state money on a program for a problem, the dimensions of which, frankly, are not known here. But I wanted to acknowledge their work and to say that I hope they'll continue to be engaged as we go forward on this. Now, to the bill itself. It is an attempt to deal with a problem that it took me a full week to get my mind around, that is the problem of sexual assault committed by children who are too young to be introduced into the criminal justice system. From about the age of 12 onward, we have juvenile courts until people get to be either reach the age of adults or get to be adjudicated to be adults, and from there we have the regular criminal courts. Generally speaking, the law doesn't reach much lower than the age of 12. The lawyers at the table will know this phrase better than I do, but the courts generally hold that children younger than that are unable to form the requisite intent to be prosecuted, which I've heard expressed as mens rea. And so, frankly, in cases where this occurs, we don't have a system to deal with it. The child welfare agencies of the state are prepared to and have the legal authority to deal with situations in which children are the victims of sexual assault. They don't really have much in the way of legal authority or ability or resources to deal with children who are the perpetrators of sexual assault. There has been a testimony in front of the task force that basically there's not really anybody in the state who knows very much about this. We don't have any statistical information to tell us how common it is or uncommon it is. And we don't have a system for dealing with it when it is reported, actually. Given that set of facts and the fact that the days were dwindling down to a precious few in the session, I decided to introduce this bill as a way of beginning what I hope will be a broader and more thorough conversation on this subject. What this bill does is it adds children who engaged in inappropriate sexual conduct and are not either supervised or treated for that to the Children in Need of Aid statute in Section 1. In Section 2, it requires a parent, guardian, or other person responsible for a child to report this kind of activity to the department. The department in this case is the Office of Children's Services. It allows the department to open a case file and investigate these charges, and it provides that a person who fails to report is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor. It defines inappropriate sexual conduct, and this is another area that may be needs work, but it was my best first cut at it, as basically conduct that would be illegal if the perpetrator were an adult rather than a child. This is to get around the question of whether or not we're trying to make it illegal for kids to play doctor. That is the content of the bill. As I said, I don't expect it to pass out of this committee, and would frankly not sure that I would vote for it if I were given the opportunity. It is just a start. Representative Dahlstrom and I and our plan to work on this over the interim. I don't think that we can really get very much done in the next 7 days, in the hopes that we can bring back to the committee at the beginning of the next session a more complete and generally acceptable bill. So with that, I think I'll just stop and try to answer any questions people might have.
Thank you. Representative Samuels and then Gruenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Dugan, for bringing it forward. I think it is an important topic, as uncomfortable as it is. You said that nothing happens now, but and maybe one of the departments is better to able to answer. What does happen now? It can't be nothing happen. If you have this happen between a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old or anybody under the age of 12, what happens now? Is it literally nothing?
Representative Samuels through the chair. I think the answer is that depends. I don't think that there's a particularly well-developed method that people can employ. I think that sometimes these are picked up in the normal course of caregivers and others who are required by law to look for children as the victims of sexual abuse. But as I said, there's not really anything in the law that requires them to do anything about a child who might be a perpetrator.
Thank you.
Representative Gruenberg.
I appreciate very much your bringing this forward, Representative Bryant. This is, I think, a really important subject. I had never heard of SBP before. Is that a recognized diagnosis in the DSM-IV?
Fortunately, Representative Gruenberg, almost everybody else who's going to talk about this knows more about it than I do. And I think someone will be able to answer that question. My understanding is that this is a relatively recently recognized phenomenon. I'm not even sure that the sobriquet it has now is common. I mean, I'm not sure that it isn't called other things in other states.
Okay. Thank you. We have quite a few people online and some folks in the audience that we would like to hear from today. So are you able to stay with us?
I am.
Great. And what I'd like to do is start with Anchorage. And if we could start with Sharon, and I'm going to massacre your last name, A-R-A-J-I.
It's Araji.
Araji. All righty, Professor Sharon Araji with UAA, and she was the head of the task force on this pre-adolescence. Sharon, please go ahead, and if you give a brief overview of the task force, then maybe others won't need to repeat that, but we do need to be cognizant of the time as we have members that need to leave at 3 for conference committees on other bills that will cause us to leave or stay here for the rest of the summer. But with that, Sharon, are you with us?
Really?
Push the button.
I do.
Push it again. Nope, still not hearing it.
Can you hear us, Sharon?
Push the button. Push it again.
Push it again. Push the button again. Please try it. We heard you for a minute. Okay, well, Anchorage is figuring that out. Let's go to Juneau Offnet, and we have online Josh Fink. Josh, if you would identify yourself and your affiliation, please.
Yes, I'm here now. Can you hear me?
Sharon.
This is Sharon?
Yes.
Okay, Josh, I apologize. We're going to put you back in line, and Sharon, please identify yourself and your affiliation.
Yes, my name is Sharon Araji. I'm professor and chair of sociology at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
All right, if you can give us your testimony, we'd appreciate it.
Yes. There is a lot known about these children nationwide and even internationally. And I started doing research on this topic over 13 years ago and actually published a book on it that's now 10 years old. And at that time, I went around and talked with most agencies in Anchorage and outside communities as well. And almost everyone in these agencies knew of these children. So it's really not an unknown entity. The problem is that there is no one in the state that has any mandate or resources to actually deal with these children. And I had sort of put this topic on the back burner after I published the book and went on to some other things until the school district case arose a couple of years ago where one six-year-old had perpetrated sexual abuse on another six-year-old in one of the Anchorage school district schools. And at that point, I started getting a lot of calls from people in the community and communities elsewhere talking about their experiences with this. So I'd first like to correct, the sort of misinformation that no one is aware of that because everyone sitting at this table is very well aware of this problem and that there are a number of children out there. When I was doing my research, we actually went into an agency and went through 102 closed files. And out of those files, we found 21 families that were characterized with children 12 and under who were sexually abusing other children. Most of this was intrafamilial. After the case was closed with the Anchorage School District, I contacted Cynthia Bradley, who's a detective over at APD, and asked if anything had been done on this issue, and she informed me that it hadn't. And that was the impetus for us putting together the task force, of which 25 people responded at our first meeting, and probably half of those have continued since November in drafting the proposed legislation we sent up to Mike Dugan. Everyone here at the table is well aware of these children, and we're also well aware that if something isn't done about them, you will see some of them, obviously not a 100% causal correlation, but if something isn't done with these children, they will either go on to have problems themselves or have additional victims. There's also national research that's been done longitudinal that shows if these children are caught early, and that's the purpose of this task force, is to identify these children early and get some form of treatment to them, that most of them caught early with a very short-term type of therapies can actually help them resolve some of their issues and hopefully prevent them from perpetrating issues. So So I'd just like to say, you know, two things, that there are a significant number of children out there. Everyone at this table knows about them and can speak to that. And with that, I would like to turn it over to, you know, some others here who can speak from their perspective.
Sharon, thank you. Could you tell us the title of your book, please?
Yes, it's called Sexually Aggressive Children, Coming to Understand Them. And it was published by Sage Publication in 1997. So you see, we have known about this for over a decade, and nothing is being done about it.
Okay, you said Sage Publications. Do you know if it's available at Barnes & Noble or any of those places?
Yes, you can order it from Barnes & Noble, and our books, UAA Bookstore, may have some copies.
Great. I will read that, as I'm sure several on this committee will. Representative Lynn?
Yes, Dr. Ranji, have you written any other books on this subject or any other subject?
Yes, I've written chapters in other books on this topic. I was just asked just a few months ago to update an article for a new journal coming out in interpersonal violence to update what is going on with these children. I go around giving workshops. I have written chapters on domestic violence, many issues related to that whole field. So, and I can provide my vita to anybody that would be interested.
Great. Thank you, Sharon, for your effort. We appreciate it. Do we have Dave Parker with APD on the line?
Yes, you do.
If you could please identify yourself, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
Yes, my name is Lieutenant Dave Parker. I'm the commander of one of the detective units that deals with crimes against children. One of the things that I wanted to just explain so that everyone there in Juneau understands, there's no way that law enforcement can effectively address this particular issue simply because these children cannot be prosecuted. There's no real legal remedy that we can take to address these cases. It's an extremely important thing. We're often contacted by schools, by other individuals, even by parents, when sexually aggressive children demonstrate or act out their behaviors with other children. And we need to understand that often in these situations, the children themselves are victims, but whether another child is victimized by an adult or an adolescent or a pre-adolescent, it doesn't really matter. They're victimized all the same. Anything that we can do to help OCS and or any other organization in the state to more effectively address this and to get these kids help, they're broken, they need help, will be money well spent and effort well spent. Do you have any questions that I might answer for you?
Not at this time, but I know we will in the future. Representative Gruenberg has a question.
Lieutenant, you said that this can't be addressed, but it looks to me like in Title 47 there are a lot of statutes allowing it to be addressed.
Were that so, we would probably not be here. Title 47 edition number 13 that is in House Bill 250, I think is the beginning stages of actually assisting Title 47 in addressing it. The difficulty we have is that the Office of Children's Services characteristically does not handle any kind of abuse which is outside of the home. If it's intrafamilial, then they're able to address it. We can address it if it is someone over the age of 12 perpetrating upon another child or an adult perpetrating on a child. The kids that fall into this crack in the system basically are kids under the age of 12 who are perpetrating upon other children. The mandatory reporting part of House Bill 250 is also, I think, very important because it adds the requirement that these kids be gotten into the system. That way, a case can be opened by OCS and a proper evaluation of the needs of those children can be made. Then a treatment plan, obviously, could be sought.
So, if I may, through the chair, It sounds like this bill, maybe for the first time, allows the treatment of a child through the child in need of aid process when the child has committed something that could be a delinquent act. It allows a different route for dealing with the child rather than the quasi-criminal route going through the child in need of aid route. And this is a first step in that direction. Is that correct, Lieutenant?
Yes. I struggle with thinking of a child under the age of 12 being considered a criminal.
Well, I'm not...
As you said, their behavior certainly could amount to criminal conduct if they were older and more capable of making proper decisions as to whether to do such a thing or not.
May I continue?
Briefly, because we have several other people on the...
Lieutenant, if this is one type of quasi-criminal activity that would be dealt with in this manner, why is it limited to inappropriate sexual behavior? Why not assaultive behavior of other types or cruelty to animals, other kinds of things that are precursors of disturbed children? Why is it limited to this?
Yeah, I can appreciate the your question in that it would seem like there are certainly other things that could be included. However, the problems that we see primarily focus upon the sexualized behavior of children, and I think children fighting and things like that, or children assaulting other children, could be reviewed approached in a different venue. This is something that needs to be done now, and these kids, when they exhibit these sexualized behaviors and perpetrate on other kids, they create a huge problem, not only for the system, but also for the individuals that they sexually molest.
Thank you.
Thank you. We appreciate your testimony, and we will be talking to you in the future on this as we continue to work on this bill. Cynthia Bradley with APD, are you online?
Yes, ma'am.
If you would identify yourself, please, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
Yes, I'm Detective Cynthia Bradley with the Anchorage Police Department. I'm one of the co-chairs for the Pre-Adolescent Sex Offender Task Force, and Dr. Araji came to me and asked me if I would help her facilitate this task force, and I have been in the Crimes Against Children's Unit at APD for the past 5 years, and I'm a 15-year veteran with Anchorage Police Department. So, I have seen and worked these cases. I actually have a specific case that I would like to share. Obviously, I won't be giving names, but the case that Dr. Araji spoke of the 6-year-old child with the school district was, in fact, my case, and I had come in contact with that child at the age of 5. And was asked by another detective to interview him, not as a perpetrator, although he was the aggressor in the case. I was asked to interview him as a victim to see if maybe he had been victimized and that's why he was acting out. And one of the things that I recall about interviewing this child was when I asked him why he did this, he said, my mind tells me to do it, and I just do it and do it and do it, which kind of... brought some red flags to me, and it was kind of disturbing to me that this child was saying this, and it was brought to the parents' attention that we were extremely concerned about this child and his behaviors, and we told the parents that he needed to get treatment and highly recommended the treatment, and ultimately, what happened is the parents minimized the situation, talked to their doctor, minimized the situation with their doctor. Basically, by the doctor was told, they're just playing doctor. It's not a big deal. Don't worry about it. Well, ultimately, it was a big deal, and it cost hundreds of thousands of dollars in a lawsuit for this family and also the school district because the child went on to perpetrate on another child, and ultimately I had 3 investigations involving this particular child, and was able to determine that he probably started acting out at the age of 4. And
So this particular case, the recommendations to the family were ignored, the recommendations to the family were ignored. As a result, the child went on to perpetrate again, and ultimately, it cost a lot of money for the city and the state because of what happened and where it happened. I currently have a case on my desk where I actually have a 12-year-old victim who's been perpetrated on since he was six by his two cousins who are less than 3 years older than him. Therefore, I can't charge them, even though now they're 14 or 15. I cannot charge them because my victim is 14 and there's not the age. I can't charge them with the sexual abuse of a minor because the age is not as to where I could charge. But in this particular case, they've been abusing this child since he was six and they were eight. So had we been able to get a hold of these kids and maybe get them some help, maybe this behavior would not continue. And now we have, two young men that are probably going to be going to jail and potentially continue to victimize. So it's a very serious situation, and the problem as a law enforcement officer that I see is my unit, the Crimes Against Children's Unit APD, has the highest assigned caseload in the detective division, and that's not including these cases where actually we probably could assign them not on the basis of the victim being perpetrated on a same age perpetrator, but if we looked at the perpetrator as also being a victim and who was victimizing that person. The problem is we're actually kind of on a fishing expedition to see if in fact they are being perpetrated on, and we're also expending resources that we don't really have to do that.
Thank you, Cynthia, for your testimony. We appreciate it, and I know we will be speaking with you again. Do we have in Anchorage Dennis Maloney?
Yes, I'm here. Excuse Hi. The cold.
Please identify yourself, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
Thank you. I was shocked when these folks walked into my office with this first case. After that became public, we received over two dozen calls. This is Dennis Maloney. Okay. Sorry. We received over two dozen calls from various people regarding children who had been perpetrated upon by other children. We investigated the facts in this case, and unlike the assumptions that Representative Dugan makes, here's what happens if the perpetrator is under 12. If the perpetrator is under 12, the police department don't charge him. In some states, for instance, in Oregon, you can charge criminally someone as young as seven. All this, I sent all of the legislators that I know of last year a package of all the state laws regarding juvenile perpetrators. In Atlanta, Georgia, there is an institution for children ages 5 to 12 who are sexual perpetrators. There's a waiting list of four-year-olds to be put in it, and the average stay is 1 to 2 years. In the case investigating this first case, we determined that there were, in fact, at least six other children anally and orally penetrated by this one boy who has an IQ above 140. When asked, among other things, he said, "My mind tells me to hurt other children." That's on tape. He is also the kind of child that hurts animals and other things. I think he's when I was young, we used to call people like this psychopaths. Now today, I think you're calling them sociopaths. But in some cases, these people, I think, are formed earlier than we think. I was literally shocked when we began to investigate this. The Office of Children's Services has received last year in Anchorage about 130 referrals regarding children under 12 with sexually inappropriate behavior on children under 12. Most of those are relatively innocent. There are a few hardcore ones. but the hardcore children seem to repeat and repeat and repeat. And some of the victims become perpetrators. In the case we are currently exploring, which occurred at in a school in a tent during summer school, an 8-year-old had sex of all types with 2 5-year-olds in a tent in the gym for 3 days. He is a victim of sexual abuse himself. The system currently does not allow him to be charged. It does not allow any there's no treatment given by the state. There's no investigation. Basically, no adult is involved. It's dropped, and that's what happened with the 6-year-old case until we brought our lawsuit. The police investigated. There was no adult. They dropped their file. Office of Children's Services investigated. Nobody in the household was involved. They closed their file. That's when we brought the lawsuit. There is no current method of dealing with this problem. Virtually every one of these people will be repeat offenders. They will enter the criminal system, and they will rape and assault other people. Our state has the highest rate of sexual assault in the country, and we must begin to address this problem. Nobody wants to think about it. I don't want to think about it. The testimony that we've had, and I think Dr. Spurbeck is waiting to testify, and I hope he can testify, because he's seen more of these children than I have, or even Lieutenant Bradley has, Detective Bradley has, because we see our own little picture, and then it goes away, you know. People in treatment facilities see more and more of these people. There are treatment facilities all over the country. Professor Renji, could I defer to her for 1 second? Do you know how many treatment facilities there are in the United States for kids under 12?
No, but probably 15.
15, she says. There are specialists in Denver and in Seattle and Oklahoma and Pennsylvania and Florida and Georgia who treat these kind of children. We have one person who's been trying to treat some of these children for a limited period of time, who has announced his retirement here in Anchorage. This requires a comprehensive approach. The cost to society is substantial. The cost to the victims is unmeasurable. For someone to lose their self-respect and to be victimized and suffer the way people who are raped suffer is just not acceptable. If we can prevent it and deal with it, we have to identify these kids and try to stop them, try to treat them to prevent them from hurting other children and going on to what will be a life of crime and which will cost society much, much more than you folks would have to spend. I suspect that if you look at the cost of having a criminal in jail for life, which many of these people will be, you recently amended your state law on people who victimize children sexually, and they are now going away for, 20 years? So let's say $100,000 a year, that's $2 million per offender. How many do we have to prevent from becoming institutionalized to make this worth? I'd say 1 or 2. How many will we prevent? The task force testimony indicated we believe there were at least in Anchorage 10 hardcore children sexually assaulting other children on an active basis who would require institutionalization. So if you think it isn't happening, you're dreaming. You need to look at this very hard, and it is a very wise use of state funds to try to prevent this from happening and to treat these tender age but sick children before they become permanently ill and are a scar that will face all of us and our children in the future. At any time, there appear to be an average of about 1,000 incarcerated sex offenders in Alaska. That's how much, folks. A lot of money, $20 million a year. No, more than that. It costs us $355,000 a year per adult sex offender. There are 1,000 of them currently in jail. That's a whole lot of money. Is that $355 million a year? What is that? $355 million? $355 million a year of the taxpayers' money. So, even though Representative Dugan doesn't believe you can afford to spend $10 million a year, I'm going to go out and try to raise some money so we can get a funded chair at UAA so we can find a professor and put them in there, like the journalism professor who will teach our psychologists in Anchorage how to handle this problem.
Thank you, Mr. Maloney. Appreciate your testimony, and I know we will be working with you again in just a moment. And two things I want to state. We do have OCS here, and we will be having the opportunity to hear from them, and I want to put on record and just clarify right away that OCS is operating within the bounds of the laws as they are written right now. And this issue has come before us, as many other issues have come before us, and we are looking at what we as lawmakers need to do to address the problem. And OCS has certain boundaries, just like APD has certain boundaries, just like all the other agencies do. I want to make sure that's on record.
Madam Chairman, I didn't mean to suggest that they weren't doing what they were charged to do, that they're limited in what they can do.
You're
we
correct.
All know that they're overworked.
Right, and I believe that I understood that from you, Dennis, but I just wanted to clarify for anybody that might be maybe reading this transcript later and didn't hear the tone of voice or anything, but I know that you do understand that. Representative Lynn has a question.
Yes, thank you. Are you the same attorney at Maloney that has a 501c3 group, anti-bullying, and do you have a similar or contemplating a similar type of organization that sits with this terrible problem that we're discussing today?
No, I do not have a similar organization. I can only do so much.
Thank you.
All righty, thank you. And anyone that's listening that has their testimony typed or written, if you would fax it to us, we would appreciate it, and we would like to provide that to all the members of the legislature. And that number is 465-2070. And even if it's just in the form of bullet points or whatever you have, it will be helpful to us. Jeffrey Magid, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Jeffrey Magid.
Magid, could you please identify yourself, and we'd like to hear your testimony?
Thank you very much. I'm Jeffrey Magid. I'm an attorney here in Anchorage. I work with Dennis Maloney on these sexual assault cases, in particular the one that Detective Bradley talked about. I have very little to add, but I will add this. The way that incident was able to occur, the way that the victim in first grade class was able to get assaulted, in part was due to the fact that the parents of the perpetrator, who originally sexually assaulted a kid in preschool, were able to transfer this child from school to school, from where he went to kindergarten, where he was the most misbehaved kid in kindergarten, according to testimony taken during that case, and where they were preparing to handle him as a discipline problem the following year. His parents were able to take him and put him in another school and not notify anybody of his sexual propensities, and the testimony in that case is very instructive on what the parents actually knew, even outside of what the OCS knew and outside of what the detectives knew. And that's why the portion of this bill that puts responsibility on parents to obtain treatment, as the detective and the Office of Children's Services recommended in that case, and providing for penalties if they don't follow that, and also the aspect of this bill that requires parents, that puts a duty on them to inform people who are charged with the supervision of children, protects potential victims, and that's one of the foci.
Thank you, Jeff, for your testimony, and I will tell you that Representative Dugan and I had a meeting before we came to committee, and every one of the issues that you addressed, as far as parental responsibility, reporting responsibilities, things that happen in the schools, reporting from school to school, every one of those issues are things that we discussed, and we know they're problems. We just don't have the answers right now, but we're committed to working on this all summer long, and having something that's workable, that OCS, that the Department of Law, and all the children that will be affected by this will benefit from. So I know we will be working with you again. In Anchorage, I have one last person listed, and that's Mary Elam. Are you there, Mary?
I am.
Please identify yourself, and we'd like to hear your testimony.
I'm Mary Elam. I'm the program director for STAR, Standing Together Against Rape. I don't have too much to add that hasn't already been covered, except to say that it's known and research has supported that the earlier the intervention and treatment comes, the more effective it is and the better chance of success. And without that kind of intervention, these children that have perpetrated sexual offenses are going to continue that behavior, and there will be more and more victims. And in many of these cases, it's very likely that the perpetrators are also victims, and the opportunity for them to receive treatment and receive intervention will also help to address those issues that they have. The effects of being a victim of sexual violence, child sexual abuse, it can be devastating, and they can be lifelong. And by providing this kind of intervention, you can, one, you're going to minimize the number of victims if you prevent this child from continuing to victimize. And you can provide some healing for that child that has perpetrated and perhaps get that child to a place where they can be productive and healthy in the future.
Thank you, Mary, for your testimony. And as a former board member of STAR, I wish you good luck in your new position, and know that the group is trying to accomplish good things. So I'm sure we'll be working with you as we progress on this also. Is there anyone else in Anchorage who wishes to testify?
That's everyone that's here today.
All right.
Is Dr. Spurbeck on the line?
He is, and I will be getting to him, yes. Josh Fink, are you with us still? And the Juno off net?
Madam Chairwoman, can you hear me?
We sure can. Please identify yourself and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. This is Josh Fink. I'm the director at the Office of Public Advocacy. While greatly appreciate the efforts of the sponsors and what they're trying to achieve with this, we have significant concerns with this legislation as written. I guess I'm going to be in the minority here, listening to the other people that have testified, but I would just start with an observation that Chief Justice Roberts made last week in Fairbanks when he was at the Alaska Bar. He expressed concern that legislatures are reacting to isolated cases, though extreme and upsetting, where the new legislation they're proposing has a much broader impact on society than simply addressing the facts of the case. This is such legislation. It has extraordinarily broad implications and inserts government oversight into every family in Alaska in ways in which I think most people would object to, and I think that is harmful to children. Section 1 adds a whole new jurisdictional ground for OCS to take children into state custody for child abuse and neglect. And while OPA finds child-on-child sex assault or inappropriate conduct absolutely reprehensible and something that needs to be dealt with, the jurisdictional ground in this legislation as written is very broad. Section 2 adds a reporting requirement for people heretofore not required to report to OCS, such as parents, guardians, and then the very broadly defined other persons responsible for a child, which is so vague I think you'd have a lot of litigation over that. It requires these new people to report that aren't mandatory reporters. And the incidents they must report are quite broad, as the definition of inappropriate sexual conduct is quite broad. It's not just sexual conduct that we would all agree should not be tolerated, but it's things like a toddler exposing and touching himself in public, or innocently touching an undeveloped breast, buttocks, or genital of another child. Under the definition with the reference statutes, those are defined as inappropriate sexual conduct. And if you don't report it, you're committing a crime. And I have to ask, would you, Madam Chairwoman, as a parent, want to be legally required to turn in your toddler when he or she pulls down his or his pants and touches his genitals in public? Or your four-year-old is engaging in normal age-appropriate play with his or her friends during a bath with his four-year-old neighbor? Do you want to be charged with a crime if you fail to report it? Do you want OCS to open a file on the case? That is what this legislation, as currently written, requires. To reiterate, the scope of the definition of inappropriate sexual conduct is far too broad. OPA has objections on a policy basis to labeling as inappropriate sexual conduct what many know by common sense and what child experts confirm to be normal pre-adolescent behavior. Children are curious, and that normal curiosity should not result in labeling or stigmatization. Nor should the failure to report it lead to possible criminal charges and an OCS file being opened. OPA is concerned about how such labels would harm children that really aren't engaging in aberrant behavior. Finally, there are notice issues, significant notice issues in the bill as written. The public is expected to know the law, but in some cases, courts find that it's not reasonable to expect the public to be on notice of some duties. This bill expects that parents, guardians, and others responsible for children, again, a very broad category, others responsible for children, know that they have a reporting requirement and know what constitutes a crime under 1141.410 through 470. And again, this could be exposure. This could be inadvertent touching through clothing. If they witnessed such an incident or had reasonable cause to believe, again, very vague, they have a legal obligation to report or they would be charged with the crime. I would suggest this may not be reasonable and has potential constitutional infirmities. I would like an opportunity, and I'm pleased to hear this legislation would be held over. I'm going to be submitting this to some of the child development experts that we here at OPA regularly work with and get some comments and evaluation on it from our experts, who, with all due respect to the previous speakers, would take some significant objection to the testimony that was just given. I will say that under current law, and we see very few of these cases. Again, I'm going to disagree with the previous testimony. And we are appointed in every case where the state takes custody. But, so I think they're very rare. And I think this legislation is reacting to what was a horrible situation. But again, it has very broad implications. And implications I don't think the public would fully support. And under current law, there was some talk about how would the situation that was described be addressed under current law. Where a parent neglects or medically neglects his or her child, the state may take that child into custody. And that could include failing to supervise or to obtain treatment of your child if the parent's made aware of behavior issues the child has. So if it's brought to a parent's attention and they don't do anything, OCS can take custody. Had this child been reported to juvenile justice, another route the case could have gone, and the agency agreed there was a concern, they could have made a report to OCS, who could have come up with an action plan. Failure to meet could have resulted in the child being taken into state custody. Alternatively, the Department of Juvenile Justice itself could recommend a course of treatment for the child. So I don't believe that our current law is completely inadequate to address these situations, and we have grave concerns about the broad reach of this legislation and would be very happy to work with the sponsors and committee on fixing this over the interim. I would add that OPA was not asked to join the task force, and we got wind of what was going on and tried to get information. We were unsuccessful. What information we did get concerned us about the punitive nature in which the task force was going. And we're talking about pre-adolescent kids, toddlers in some cases, and I'm just, again, seriously concerned about the reach of this legislation. I look forward to working with you, Madam Chairwoman, and the committee.
Thank you, Josh, for your testimony, and I want you to know that Representative Dugan and I do welcome your participation in our work that we will be doing throughout the summer and fall on this. We look forward to it and also to hearing from the other experts and folks that you mentioned. And I will mention again in the conversations that Representative Dugan and I had that definition of inappropriate sexual conduct. We know we have a lot of work to do on that. We know reporting procedures, we know we have to work to do. And if you heard his opening statements, he said this is not a perfect bill. It's a start. And I think it's a start. Everybody has the right intent. So we're gonna continue working. So thank you for that. And we are also aware, as with any legislation that we pass, of unintended consequences and try to look to the future of all the things that may or may not transpire because of something that we do, hoping to fix something. So that isn't going unnoticed. And Representative Lynn has a question for you.
But I know what's in the bill, but how much does it get into potential for civil litigation in cases where some child or could be accused of such a thing? what kind of litigation, civil litigation, could be brought forth?
Who's the question for, Representative Lynn?
The last testifier.
For Mr. Fink, did you hear that question?
Madam Chairwoman, it was somewhat difficult to hear. Was the question what sort of civil litigation might result?
Yeah, I thought I had the microphone turned away, sir. What type of civil litigation, if any, might this, if this bill were to pass in its current form, might that bring forth?
Through the chair, Representative Lynn, you know, I'm not sure, and Mr. Maloney might be better able to answer that. I don't know, you know, if a parent doesn't report the way the bill's written, it's a crime. And so you could argue, you know, civilly negligence per se, if they fail to report, they've committed a crime, and if you fail to do conduct required of you, that would be negligence per se. So it would be easier, I suppose, to prove a negligence or personal injury case against a parent who failed, or any other responsible adult who failed to report a child they're responsible for inappropriate sexual conduct.
And again, for the sake of time, if I could just interject that this bill will not be passing in the form that it is in, won't be leaving this committee in the form that it is in, and so I want to hear everybody's testimony that we have.
I hope this question could be explored as we go through the interim.
It will. It will absolutely be. Let's see. David Spears. Oh, I apologize. Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before Mr. Fink gets off the line here, I would appreciate it if his continued participation, he could point out to me in 1141, 410 through 470, where indecent exposure is a felony, which is what's required under the current definition. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. David Spearbeck, are you on the line? This would be the Juno off net. Do we still show him? We don't show him. I'm hoping maybe someone can get him online. Several people in Anchorage reference that they would like to hear from him. I have folks from the Division of Behavioral Health here for questions. Jan Rutherdale from Department of Law is here to answer questions. Is there anyone? Jan, if we could ask you to come up and... Hi, welcome. Please identify yourself. And
yes, my name is Jan Rutherdale. I'm an Assistant Attorney General in the Department of Law, Human Child Protection Section.
All right. Are there any specific questions for Jan from members at this time? Jan was Representative Holmes.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering if she would share with us some of her views, what we just heard from Mr. Fink, whether you concur with any of that, or what types of areas in working over the interim the bill sponsor and the committee might want to be looking into.
Okay. I actually do agree with what Mr. Fink said. I think that there are some constitutional problems with the bill, and so I think it would be important to, well, a couple things. I agree with him that with respect to Section 1, which is expands the jurisdictional statute, I think that, I think we can get there through the current legislation, so I don't think Section 1 is necessary. And I guess I share Mr. Fink's take that it's a new jurisdictional ground, and I shared Representative Groomberg's that where do we go from here? I mean, is this going to open the door to many other similar grounds? But in any case, I do believe that it's we can currently get involved in a family under those at that fact pattern. So I don't think it's necessary. Section 2, the mandatory reporting, I think there's some privacy problems with that. There may be even a problem of self-incrimination involving a parent who is observing. You know, it could be an accessory to the fact or something. So you're requiring them to self-incriminate themselves. The difficulty of trying to how you define inappropriate sexual conduct. It seems very overbroad and vague. Because the problem is when you refer to adults, the statute, the sexual abuse statutes talk about usually ages, you know, under 13, over 16, that sort of thing, and so it's kind of a legal fiction. You don't know, are you referring to any age children, you know, five-year-olds perpetrating on other five-year-olds, or do you want to retain that three-year? We just don't know under this. Also, are you referring to consensual conduct, or does it have to be non-consensual conduct? Again, that's difficult because legally children aren't able to legally consent to be to being touched. So those are some of the problems that I could see. But I would be more than happy to work with them on fixing it.
Thank you. Great. Any further questions for Jan? Jan, thank you so much, and we look forward to working with you this summer.
Thank you.
Next, have Mike Lessman from Department of Health and Social Services and with specific responsibilities in OCS. If you'd come forward and identify your name and position, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. For the record, my name is Mike Lessman. I'm the Community Relations Manager for the Office of Children's Services here in Juneau. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you about House Bill 250. Having met with Representative Dugan earlier in the session and spending some time with him and his staff yesterday and today, I am convinced that he wants to do the right thing by children and families. I'm convinced that he wants to find the right solution to a real problem. Having said that, the Office of Children's Services is also unable to support this proposed legislation. We recognize the importance of treating children with sexual behavioral problems and protecting other children from those children that do have those problems. We recognize there have been some alarming reports about incidents like these here in Alaska in the recent months and couple years. We also recognize the very impressive multidisciplinary team approach that the task force has taken on and the work they've done. But we simply can't support legislation that would require the public to report all of these sexually inappropriate incidents between pre-adolescent children to our staff, exclusively in the absence of any parental culpability. Madam Chair, I'm sure this was not the intent of this legislation. I'm convinced of that, as a matter of fact. But if you think about that mother, that father who gets the knock on the door from the OCS social worker, if you think about this from their perspective, I believe this legislation would imply to them that OCS doesn't believe parents are capable of doing what they've been doing quite well, most of them, since the beginning of time, which is to talk about their children, about good touch, bad touch, personal privacy issues, personal space, to educate them about the birds and bees. Legislating mandatory reporting in this regard seems to imply that the Office of Children's Services should be the first line of defense, when in fact we would rather be the last line of defense. If parents aren't responding to their children's needs and their behaviors, and then the second chance comes with some school official or some other person that's caring for that child during the course of the day, bringing the problem to mom and dad's attention, if that second line of defense doesn't work, OCS can and does get involved in these types of cases. If there's an allegation that mom and dad are not being protective of the children in their home from the sexual predator, if mom and dad are not getting the treatment services that have been recommended for the child perpetrator, if mom and dad are somehow negligent or simply uncaring of what's happening at the expense of the children in the home, the children they provide care and support to. The child protection statutes, Title 47, Chapter 10, are written such that OCS can intervene in these types of situations, and we do. Madam Chair and committee members, I ask you, as we work through this legislation in the interim, or even as it sits here right here today, I just implore you to ask yourselves if you really want OCS to be more things to more people. If you want us to take on this work, we have to ask for the resources. If you want us to take on child welfare issues and not just child protective services issues, we are going to ask our staff to do a lot more work than they're already doing, and frankly, ask them to do work that's in addition to the work we're mandated to do now, and don't feel like we can do well enough. Happy to answer any questions that you might have for me. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members of the committee? All right, thank you, Mr. Lisman, for your testimony. We appreciate it. And one thing I'd like to say, we do have one person online, our last person to testify, and that's Dr. David Spurnack. But I do want to thank everyone that has testified. Being involved in this kind of work is not an 8-to-5 job. It's something that consumes your life 24 hours a day, and I'm sure some of the cases and things that you are involved with are very heart-wrenching, and we take this legislation very seriously because of the victims being children, because of the impact that it has on the rest of their lives, and the responsibilities that we're asking other people to potentially step up and take. But I just would like to thank everyone for their continued willingness to stick with this. So, Dr. Spurbeck, are you with us?
This is Dave Spurbeck.
Spurbeck, I apologize. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi, I'm. Would you like me to testify at this point, Madam Chairman?
Please, and if you'd identify your affiliation, your title.
Yes, I am a forensic and clinical psychologist specializing in pediatric psychology and neuropsychology. For 24 years, I was the forensic psychologist for the state of Alaska in all criminal matters, and provided the majority of the court-appointed psychiatric evaluations in our criminal system statewide. Also, during the last 20 years, I've had my outpatient private practice clinic at North Star Hospital. And over the past year, since I fully retired from the state, I've been the psychological services director and chief psychologist at North Star Hospital, which is a children and adolescent psychiatric facility. I can testify in support of this bill primarily from the perspective of having examined several thousand adult sexual offenders and probably at least 1,000 children and adolescents who were engaged in problematic sexual behaviors as well. One thing I can assure you is that certainly these children are not born misbehaving sexually. They are usually the product of, if not abuse, certainly neglect, and are typically not picked up or monitored or supervised until they get into adolescence. Rarely, if ever, do adolescents act out for the first time in adolescence if they have sexual behavior problems. their problems almost always can be identified at an earlier age and have been. And the one thing that I really support about this legislation is the mandatory evaluation and assessment. I can assure you that psychologically, if a child's personality problems are not addressed and remedied by the age of 10 or 11, there's really not a whole lot of change any kind of therapy can make in that person in terms of changing the course of their personality. Therapy doesn't change your personality after age 10 or 11. Their personality is set. And if they have an exploitative or predatory or narcissistic or sociopathic personality by that age, it's really a question of damage control after that point, not damage prevention. If you can get to them sooner and provide them with resocialization or types of cognitive behavior therapy that are available, then we stand a chance of fixing them and slowing down the what I consider to be the extraordinary epidemic of narcissistic, selfish acting out that so many sexual offenders demonstrate later in life. I mean, it's one of the reasons why sex offender treatment is so has such poor outcome results in adults, is because it's a function of their personality more than a mental disease or defect. So, in any case, I certainly heard the testimony of the OCS worker earlier, and certainly I concur with some of his reservations that adding more to an already overworked and beleaguered group of dedicated professionals is going to be extremely difficult. But I can assure you that certainly a ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure later on with these children, and it's absolutely crucial for not just reducing the potential number of perpetrators, but also addressing the needs of the potential victims by preventing and stemming the exposure to more abuse.
I have a question for you from Representative
yes.
Samuels.
Thank you. I think it's good to hear from you, Dr. Spurbeck. For the children under the age of 10, you said the therapy. How long, realizing that there's no set answer, but I'd like one anyway, how much therapy, how long? Is it a couple of years, a couple of months? Did you have to remove these people, obviously, from the environment that got them there? How much of this can happen, and how many people are we talking about, do you think, in the state of Alaska?
Well, those are phenomenal questions, certainly, and right on point. It depends on the magnitude of the problem. I mean, I've seen children already this morning here who have been exposed to actual sexual conduct and activity by their parents or their parents' friends. This morning I saw a child who's constantly exposed to pornography. I mean, these are children between the ages of 7 and 9 years old. It depends on just how serious a person's problem is, how long they've been exposed to this, to what extent they have developed virtues and values in other areas of their lives, what kind of support they have. It's very difficult to put a child like that back in the home after the parent is, if the parent is responsible and unwilling to accept responsibility and accountability for their conduct, then the child has to be removed from the home. They have to be sort of placed either in a hospital setting for a while and then transferred to residential treatment for a while and placed maybe in a therapeutic foster home for a period of time so that they can start developing a semblance of normalcy and stability and value development. So it depends. What are the numbers? I would say probably for the children that I see, this hospital probably sees 2,000 new patients a year. I would say maybe 10% of them have sexual behavior problems that are significant enough to actually get them into the hospital setting. So I would say probably somewhere between 100 and 200 have very serious problems. And I think that North Star probably sees the vast majority of the severe behavior and personality and psychiatric problems among children in this state. So from that perspective, probably somewhere between 100 and 200 a year, I would say, would need evaluations. Maybe half of them would probably need to be removed at least temporarily from the home so that a period of stabilization and resocializing can occur, and so that the parents can get the kind of education that they need. Parenting is extraordinarily difficult these days. I mean, it's hard to be a good parent when it takes three paychecks. It's hard to be a good parent when you're intoxicated. So the whole issue of addressing the real problem, which is parental negligence, has to also be factored into this problem.
Follow up? All right, thank you. If you proceed with your testimony.
Well, that's really that's the sum and substance of what I wanted to address. I know some of the people involved in this task force, and they are very credible, very intelligent, and certainly very dedicated to children. And I would support their efforts in working out some kind of a proposed solution to make this happen.
Thank you very much. We appreciate all you do to help children and all you've done in your years as a forensic psychologist for the state. We are, as stated previously, going to hold this bill. And I'd like to invite Representative Dugan up to the table for just a minute. I'll allow him to just have the last few words on this. But again, I want to state, in talking with all the parties involved, people from the task force, people from OCS, people from the Attorney General's office, people from OPA, people from all, you will all be invited, and Representative Dugan and I will be very disappointed if you don't participate in helping us this summer to craft a piece of legislation that is good, that will allow the departments to do what they need to do, and that will provide them the resources that they need so that they can do it, and with our ultimate intent being that we serve the children of our state and protect them. So, Representative Dugan, I'll turn some closing remarks over to you.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman. I think you've actually made my closing remarks for me. I'd like to say that I'm looking forward to doing this. In fact, that's not true. But I am willing to do it. I think it needs to be done. I'm hoping that everybody who testified and everybody who finds out about this now, that we have hopefully elevated its profile a little bit, who has something to offer, will come and offer it. And I think that's all I've got in the way of closing remarks, except to ask that we continue to hold the public hearing open as well, in the hopes that when we come back in the fall, we'll be able to be talking about a more fully fleshed out proposal.
Mr. Chairman, I don't anticipate being here in the fall, so let's not do that.
Manager.
Sorry, Representative Coghill. I wouldn't presume to say whether we'll be here in the fall or not, but whenever we get back here.
And Representative Dugan, my intent is that as you and I sit down and come up with a schedule and notify all the parties and people involved, that we will probably be meeting at the LIO in Anchorage, and we will make those publicly noticed and publicly available to everybody and all the parties, you know, that are there, and we will continue to work through this. So with that, I'd like
Chair,
to
I just want
Representative
to,
Lynn.
When we get into this, you know, obviously we have to protect children. We've been talking about this all afternoon. We also have to somehow in the process protect parental rights. It's a very delicate balance, parental rights, and we can't go too far in either direction. Thank you.
You did a very good job of stating that, and I think that's a concern of many of the people on this committee, and that's something that Department of Law is concerned about too, that we don't cross lines, you know, that abuse one, but
that's right.
You know, vice versa.
Abuse
so
on either side.
Thank you. With that, it is 10 to 4, and this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.